This is RevTech Podcast, where we discuss everything from business processes to measurement and technical alignment. The RevTech mission focuses on effectively managing and optimizing the go-to-market strategy through methodologies, tools, and best practices. We discuss the success criteria and technical fit guides for decision-making and ensure solutions align with the business goals. Our today's guests are Jamal Elmich from Malcolm Clay Search and Kyle Caravelli from Fisher Cat Consulting. Welcome on the pod.
Happy to be here.
We have a special edition this time. I don't think we ever discussed the go-to-market hiring process, so I think it's a great opportunity at the end of the year to have you on and discuss the best practices. I know you guys have a lot of experience working with the startups, bringing the best resources and candidates. So I'm looking forward to have this conversation and share that with our audience.
Looking forward to it.
I'm excited to have this conversation, do something a little bit different. And I think it's been a tumultuous couple of years when it comes to hiring in the go-to-market space. Just to kick things off, I want to hear about both your stories and how you became a recruiter and why you find it interesting and have stuck with it. So Jamal, do you want to kick things off and give us your background and story?
Age before beauty, I guess, right? That's how we're doing this. When I started recruiting, it was basically by luck. An old college teammate ran into him at a sporting goods store, and I was just done with kind of doing my professional track thing, and he was done with his. And so we just started just talking about what we were doing, and he mentioned that he was in recruiting and at the time, you know, working at an agency. And he started talking about all the kind of fun stuff that he was able to buy because of, you know, recruiting. And so that sounded good to me, and so that's kind of how I landed in it. And so started at an agency. It was really interesting at the time because there was no LinkedIn. So this goes way back where we had to really, you know, reach out using the phone book, using ads in the newspaper to call into companies to see if they would use our services. So very quickly got to build a pretty good sales muscle, if you will, doing outbound calls to companies and outbound calls to candidates. What I started to really love about it was just the connections that I was able to make with people. And so that's kind of where it took off for me. It was really the connections and getting to know people and getting to see people going to these cool tech companies and doing cool stuff. And so, that's how I got started.
Where was your college track career, more importantly?
I competed for the USC Trojans.
Very nice.
You see that jersey in the background there. It's one of my favorite college athletes of all time, Reggie Bush.
There you go.
There you go.
And Kyle, what about on your side?
Yeah, it's your anecdote, Jamal. I think there's a lot of parallels. I guess you could say Pac-12/Pac-10 former athlete myself, although I did not go to USC. I played rugby at Cal. But like yourself, kind of fell into recruiting after graduating and kind of prioritizing sports for most of my undergrad career. It was kind of what's next. I was fortunate enough to have the opportunity to intern at an executive search firm in San Francisco. Kind of around the time, I think you could say the second dot-com boom was taking off. And after that, you know, kind of fell in love with it. Shortly thereafter, they hired me on full time. And one of the reasons I've stuck with it, I think that it's really twofold. On one hand, one thing that I really like about recruiting is just the positive impact that you can have on someone's life. I mean, the reality is, for better or worse, you spend more time with the people you work with than your own family. So, you know, in that sense, hopefully showing someone a great opportunity where they can be successful. And then secondly, the people ultimately are what's going to make a company successful. So the ability to have a meaningful impact on a company scaling, getting the right people on board at the right time, that's been something really exciting for me.
Yeah, I also got my first job from a college teammate out of college. So it seems like a good entry way to the job force with sports. So switching gears just a little bit, I think me and Demetrius understand and talk a lot about how important it is for a company to have strong go-to-market leadership. I'd love to hear a little bit from your perspective on why that's so critical. I think you can have a great product, but if you don't have a good go-to-market strategy, it doesn't matter. So I'd love to hear your opinion on that.
Absolutely. So I think you kind of hit the nail on the head, Lizzie, and I think that's kind of my take on it as well. And, you know, I generally will say that in technology, there's two things that a company needs to be successful. They need, you know, a product and people to build it. And then secondly, someone to actually sell it. And in these days, in terms of, you know, I think everyone likes using recurring revenue as a fun term. So I think it's even become increasingly important to think of, you know, that go-to-market strategy holistically, not just people to, you know, get the product in the door, but to continue to see adoption, upsell opportunities like that. So just in general, I will say I view go-to-market leadership specifically to kind of build the strategy, build the process, the team as critical for a company's ability to succeed.
Yeah, Jamal, I'd love to hear your perspective too. And then if you see any like common pitfalls that companies tend to face when they don't prioritize certain areas and go to market.
I kind of think a go to market is really like the navigation, right? I mean, they're really the ones, if you have a strong go to market leader, he or she is really helping you see around the corner, right? So collecting data from customers, collecting data from the market, collecting data from competitors, and really making sure that that engine's always fine tuned, always figuring out, you know, how do we build a better mousetrap? And I think part of that is being able to see around those corners, but also understanding how do I collaborate right with the other departments? How do I, you know, stay connected to engineering? How do I stay connected to product? How do I stay connected to marketing? So I think this is where, as we think about some of the evolution of particular roles, where I think RevOps, right? No, not to pat you guys on the back there, but that's, I think this is where RevOps has really been able to take a nice trajectory into like where we are now in the workforce. And so I think some of the common pitfalls with go-to-market is really sometimes just hiring it too late. We have this founder-led sales. We're talking about early-stage companies. That's where we see the biggest pitfall is founders want to hold on to it too much. They'll say they have customers, but they're really friends and family, so they haven't really done any true evangelizing or handling objections. And so I think the sooner you can kind of bring in either that sales motion leader or even that sales ops or rev ops person to really help to lay the right foundation, I think that's what will propel companies to have more success sooner, right? Understanding what the ideal customer profile, getting that true customer feedback, is the product in the right direction? So good, strong go-to-market leaders, that's what they provide, right? They provide the right intel to make sure that that wheel is always moving in the right direction.
Yeah. I've grown up mostly in like the business development side of things, and I fancy myself a good salesperson. But then once I see a full-fledged like sales policy and roadmap and tools, I'm like, oh, I'm not a salesperson. So it's a good thing for people to recognize in themselves. And I mentioned this up top a little bit, but you know, the landscape in the go-to-market world and the tech space has changed quite a bit when it comes to hiring, and we've seen a lot of layoffs. And I'm curious to hear how things have changed in the recent years, particularly around executive recruiting for go-to-market, and what are some of the biggest challenges recruiters face in finding top talent in those areas?
The biggest change right now, and what I continue to hear as I, you know, network with other exec recruiters, both that are or some that are even in-house, is really the new concept of doing more with less. Right? I think really what we're looking for are people that understand how to scale. So it isn't the whole adage of, you know, someone that's been at the big company and took it from 100 million to 200, but it's really saying who's gone from zero to 10, right? That's a lot more impressive. That means that someone's got the right grit, they've got the right muscle to understand how the landscape works, or it could be someone that went through some downtimes historically. So whether they were at, let's say, a B company, but were successful, right? They were able to take that B company from, you know, 50 million to 100 million, and you're going, wow, they were the B player in that market, but this person was able to have success there. So I think for us, that's typically what most people are looking for now. They're not looking for the ex Salesforce person that was, you know, over some big, you know, business unit. But really maybe the person that was under them that had more of the challenge of building out specific sectors, different geos. So I think that's really kind of what I've been seeing more, is really this idea around, you know, can you do more with less? And can you even roll up your sleeves sometimes, right? Then we want people that understand that. And additionally, from a technology standpoint, right? Are you adaptable to what's going on now with technology? Are you finding ways to either integrate it in or at least being aware of what's out there?
What about from your perspective, Kyle?
Yeah, no, I definitely second a lot of what Jamal said, and I'll kind of answer this on a macro level. I think one thing that we've been seeing really in terms of how investment has operated in the last, call it, year and a half, 2 years, one thing is I think we're seeing a bigger return to just business fundamentals. Oftentimes, I mean, if we were having this conversation 5 years ago, I think most investors were asking, you know, how big can this company get in a short period of time? And these days, the conversation is often, what's the path to profitability? What's revenue going to look like? So I think the macro dynamics have shifted a little bit, and certainly that's impacted go-to-market, obviously. You know, one thing that I'm finding is, I think a lot of Jamal's comments about doing more with less are certainly the case there, where companies are increasingly cash conscious, you know, very mindful about where they're putting their money. But I think the function as a whole in terms of go-to-market is a lot more analytical and data-driven than it's ever been before. I think we have a tremendous amount of access to data and metrics that can inform our decisions. And I think these days you really need to be a bit more holistic in terms of your strategy and kind of seeing the wider picture in terms of, you know, your approach and really being mindful about what the data is telling you.
Yeah. And I think that ties back to kind of what Jamal was saying around operations and RevOps leaders becoming a pivotal piece of the go-to-market because of that data-driven approach and being able to pull all that together. It's been interesting to see leaders who have been leading from 2010 to 2020, when money was pretty cheap for the most part. Like, there were some ups and downs, but now pivoting into this day and age, and how do they handle focus on profitability without being able to throw money at things? So it is requiring a different skill set than what the market has been.
Yeah, I'd even add to that point at Sequoia. That was one of the things they talked a lot about, right? Was making sure you keep the main thing the main thing. So a lot of times companies will start to have these science projects and they're like, we can't do science projects right now, right? Capital is king. You have to be able to hold on to that pretty tight. So let's just make sure that, right, what we're doing is around innovation, around what the core product is. And as capital starts to free itself up, then we can have more science projects. But for now, let's just keep the main thing the main thing.
You know, arguably everything is cyclical, right? So we are somewhere in the phase of that cycle. I don't know if this is the end or the beginning of something else, but definitely there's a shift towards the different qualities and attributes of successful go-to-market leaders. So I want to ask you, Kyle, how you see this area, right? Like, what are the essential leadership qualities that you look for when you hire go-to-market executives? Or are you actually recommending candidates for these positions?
Yeah, so with regards to leadership qualities, I'll kind of, part of my answer, I think, is conditional on the companies I support. And it's worth noting that who I work with, it's everything from pre-seed to Series C. So there's plenty of times where I work with literally a founder and he's the only person at the company. And I think what comes with that is really a handful of different qualities, if you will, or attributes when it comes to a go-to-market leader these days. And it's sort of dovetailing off of the previous answer in terms of people being really analytical and data-driven. It's kind of a unique combination of high IQ and EQ, you know, people who are intellectually curious, really understand the product. Empathy is a big one. You know, there may be a time where an inherent aspect of go-to-market leadership is kind of recruiting and building the team out underneath you and being able to empathize with whoever's reporting into you, but also the customer. Someone who's detail-oriented, and this is another thing that we've touched on previously, but I think there's an element of this function at an early stage company where you're going to have to wear a lot of hats. You're going to have to roll up your sleeves and jump in with the SDR and get on the phone for a discovery call. You're going to have to get your hands dirty with RevOps and some of those aspects as well. And someone who's not shy from diving into the details and working hard. I'm a big believer that great leaders are people that their reports want to follow. And that's definitely a hallmark that I've seen in terms of that go-to-market function. You kind of have a cohort of people who are very loyal to a specific leader who will follow that person from company to company, even if the industry may fundamentally be a little bit different. So I think that's pretty important. Someone who can lead by example. They're not going to tell you one thing if it's not something that they wouldn't, you know, dive in and do themselves.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned the domain and also the industry specific. So I agree with you. There's probably a higher demand of these days on the specialists and the people who actually can demonstrate the expertise being in the one industry, couple of the same roles, right? I think the market is also preferring someone that is moving laterally from role to role with some additional expansion of tasks and prerogatives. But a core element is domain, right? What is the industry domain that is driving the hiring process? So Jamal, how you approach this area, how you discuss this with your customers when it comes to the domain expertise?
I think there's certain, like, I know in cybersecurity is one of them where domain is typically hardcore. Like, they really want to make sure someone knows that space inside and out. I think there are some where you could maybe loosely bring in, you know, maybe that someone that's not spot on, but has shown great ability to scale and grow. But I do think, you know, understanding, is this a company that's PLG versus enterprise? So certain things like that. Consumption-based models now starting to become the in vogue term to use. So I think domain is going to be critical in certain spaces for sure. But I do think there are times where you're just going to take the person that's the strongest, that you know has the ability to scale and grow, has had repeated success. and is able to adapt, right? So they may have come from different industries, but can really go into an industry, look through it, unpack what it is, and then be able to put together a nice roadmap and playbook that they can use to kind of fit into that.
I see this across the board in these conversations as well that I have. But another piece I notice is the cultural fit. This is an important piece in any interview, I guess, right? Everyone's trying to evaluate whether the candidate is really going to fit. Kyle, you mentioned the EQ as an important part of the qualities that leadership needs to demonstrate. How important is this right now in the conversations with your customers?
Yeah, so I'll kind of answer this in a bit of a roundabout way. And I'm curious, Jamal, what your take is on this. But I think I don't love the phrase culture fit. And why I say that is I think a lot of companies fall into this trap of they want this cookie cutter archetype. And it's just kind of a very narrow view for the candidate that's going to come in and ultimately be able to get the job done. I think, to be frank, like, we're not hiring for your best friend. We're hiring for someone who's going to come in and be a professional and get the job done. So I try to encourage teams to, you know, really just look at exceptional individuals that are fundamentally going to add something different to the team that's not already there. Provided the person's not, you know, super rude or arrogant, I'd like to think we can have a bit of an open aperture for culture, as long as they're not going to come in and be really disruptive. So as much as I can, I try to encourage people to, you know, just index on a couple key things: humility, people who aren't too arrogant, who can kind of just come in and add something different to the team. And when you're thinking through the go-to-market function in general, I think the ability to have a bunch of different thoughts represented is ultimately going to pay some dividends in terms of your ability to sell that product to anybody.
I like the way you put a leader someone wants to follow, because I actually think that's what a cultural fit is looking for. And sometimes you need someone who's a bit different. I think the humility is a good one, though, because sometimes leaders come in and they're like, I just want to bring in my people. And it's like, well, I'm sure a bunch of these people are pretty good on the team already. And maybe you can have the humility to, like, get to know why they couldn't get things done or what that looks like, and help them. There's going to be a balance there sometimes.
For sure.
Like the point Kyle brought up, the term that someone used the other day that I love was a culture add, right? So someone that could come in and provide a little something different. And I've always appreciated candidates that come from different companies, because when you are at different companies, you get different perspectives. So the guy that's been at Salesforce or IBM for 30 years, I think there's very little, right, that they can offer to a company sometimes, because they've just been machined into that thinking the way that is. But when you go to different companies, right, you get different perspectives. And so being able to bring that in and say, hey, when I was at company X, we went through X, and this is how we got to Y. So I think sometimes, you know, that culture add, that's what that could kind of resemble, right? Is someone that says, yeah, you know, I've seen different things and here's some different playbooks, but here's where I think it could, you know, work in this particular situation.
Effective culture is when you constantly stimulate the group of people and think in different ways, right? Uh-huh. I think that's kind of learning process, right? Like if you're trying to learn something, new area, you know, domain, whatever that is, you got to get out of your comfort zone. And I think when somebody's bringing the different perspective, you know, assuming with the good intentions, I think it's just good addition in the conversation. And then you're confronting this, right? I think we too often are afraid of using this word, confrontation. It doesn't have to be debilitating. It could be constructive, could be argument-based, could bring some evolution on our perspectives as well, and pose the right questions. You know, we might not get the answers, or we might not agree on the direction, but at least we start thinking about things.
I read something last week that talked just about that, right? How there could be healthy conflict. As long as that's not, you know, beat them up, drag out. But what it allows you to do is to think like, well, I didn't see that point of view. Yep. And hopefully you go research to go. And really the conversation was around, and not to get political, it was around, you know, getting vaccinated versus not getting vaccinated. And so one was deathly opposed to vaccination, one was for it. But as they started to really see each other's point of view from a different perspective, they were able to kind of find some common ground. I mean, they still felt the way they felt, but at least they go, okay, I could see your point. I can see your point. So I do think there are times just where there is healthy conversation, a healthy conflict, if you will, right? To kind of get to a specific goal. The leaders that I've always respected most when they came into a new situation were those that knew they had the power to make a lot of change, but they were just a fly on the wall for the first quarter. They just wanted to see how things worked. You know, they could make a slight change here or there, but they weren't trying to come in with the bulldozer to just change everything and go, oh yeah, I've got the power to do it. It was more so like, there probably are some good things around here. Obviously, they brought me in, so there's some changes that need to be made. But how do I want to do that respectfully?
I like to call it healthy tension. Like, I feel like almost every team, you have an overarching goal that's the same, but your way to get there is different, right? And so how do you balance out through healthy tension or confrontation or conflict the best route for us all to get on board with?
This gets us to another point, right? Like, how all of that is helping us as an organization to adopt to the new environment, right? That is changing. I mean, look at the 2 years ago, a little bit more, we didn't have a ChatGPT. Now we have it. Every conversation is about some form of AI, how this is going to impact my job, et cetera, right? And I think if you have this stiff, very rigid point of view on something, I don't think you're going to make a progress. Right. Yeah. So, yeah, Jamal, what is your take on that adaptability process and how important it is for the leaders to bring and be selective to your point? You have a limited time when you have to make a change so that it has an impact. How important it is for a CEO or C-level team to hire the individuals that will lead their own specific areas?
It's crucial. I mean, we could just look at Intel right now, right? I mean, if we just want to take something that's present day, right? Like, you had this opportunity to kind of be in the forefront and NVIDIA is just wiping you out. You could look at the, you know, Netflix versus Blockbuster, right? So just things where if you just stayed ahead of it and you were able to adapt, technology is changing. And to your point with AI, it's changing every day quickly. So those that, you know, can't move with that are failed to be sucked up and doomed by that. In the world of recruiting, I have those friends and former colleagues that are old school, right? They don't want to use AI for anything. And I'm like, okay. You know, at your own death wish, right? Do that.
You're getting people that telling you that they don't want to use it for anything?
They feel like there's just the way to do it, right? There's the old school way. And I'm like, things change. I myself have taken AI classes because I'm like, I want to know how this works. I want to understand that. I'm going to have to work with people that are particularly younger than me in some sense. And so I want to be able to speak their language. And I'll work with people that are older than me and I want to help to bring them along. So for me, even in recruiting, there's adaptability, right? That we have to do and we have to be mindful of. And so I think from a go-to-market standpoint, if you're not thinking about, once again, what's around the corner, you're doomed. You're going to fail your company for sure.
Kyle, what is your take on this?
One thing that my mind kind of goes to with regards to recruiting anyways, in terms of the adaptability, I mean, certainly there's a lot of technology and tools that we have at our disposal, but to a degree, the market changes as well. And in recruiting, you deal with people. So I think you need to be conscious of, like, at the moment, I think we're in a very kind of employer-centric market, and we may get into this a little bit later, but I think we're at a point where a really attractive company can make certain demands of a really high-performing employee that they wouldn't have been able to 5 years ago. So that's just a bit of a different shift. And I think certainly with regards to the go-to-market space, staying ahead of just approach technology, I think it's huge. The other thing that I think is interesting, if you look at the technology space, I'm a big believer that there's a certain person who can come in and do a great job when a company's at its infancy, kind of in that building phase. And then that same person may not have the adaptability to see that company scale. And then past the scale, when it's possibly, you know, $100 million, $1 billion plus company, that's a very different person. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it's a very unique individual, I think, who has the adaptability to be dangerous and be high performing in all those different situations. It's just fundamentally different problems that the company is experiencing.
That's a very good point.
That's a great point. Yeah.
Yeah. As someone who's worked at companies that are mostly like 300 or 1,000 people, I'm like, this is my sweet spot. And I think people find their different sweet spots of and what they enjoy too, right? Like, I don't want to be a cog in the wheel, but some people love to work at bigger companies, right? So there's some preference there too. We chatted a lot about the individual, but I want to switch gears a little bit, talk more about like the holistic go-to-market teams, and would love to hear what are some of the key factors you think contribute to high-performance go-to-market teams and how recruiters help companies build out those teams. Kyle, let's start with you on this one.
Yeah, so one thing, just personally, a lot I've been thinking about as I'm scaling my own practice is the function of business development. And it's one of those things where I'm going to a lot of friends of mine and former colleagues who are in the function and honestly just trying to learn as much as I can about exactly what you said. You know, what are the key factors that make people and teams in that function successful? A big takeaway that seems to be a consistent theme is discipline. I think that one's huge. You know, some good advice that I got recently is There's just so many different things that can happen during the work week, but, you know, look for those individuals who block out time on their calendar to still just do outbounds. You know, give yourself, if it's, you know, a certain metric in terms of messages sent or spending an hour each day just kind of prospecting, I think that's huge. Just kind of having the discipline and grit to roll your sleeves up and be very action oriented and disciplined in terms of your own calendar and approach. I think that's massive. You know, we were talking about it earlier, but empathy with the customer, I think is huge too. Mm-hmm. Sales these days, or I should say the go-to-market function, I think is less around, oh, you need my solution, but just being thoughtful and listening to the problem that, you know, the given customer is facing. And if you're not the right solution, that's okay. That's still pointing them in the right direction. And maybe they'll remember that and circle back to you when the timing's appropriate, where your tool or product is something that they'll actually need. So I think that's a big one. And then being data-driven, again, I think there's just so many different tools out there in terms of being able to capture metrics and just understand intelligently your approach and shape that. And I think that's one of those hallmarks of a good team. Just the data and numbers are there, and it's just a matter of looking at it, listening to those numbers. I mean, it's pretty black and white. I don't think data or analytics lie. So up to you to kind of draw those conclusions from it and really kind of course correct and change strategy or even improve it, right? I mean, it could be a massive difference if, you know, you're driving up that positive response rate from 2-4%. Think about the time that it's going to save you, just that little incremental improvement. And it could be something incredibly simple that you can use to tweak that, if that answers your question, Lizzie.
Yeah, no, it does. I think one of the factors of AI is like the companies are built really quickly that can do similar things to your company, right? And so the sales approach has to be, I tell our salespeople, like a little bit more like partnerships or BD. Like you're building a relationship, hopefully it will turn into something one day. But if that day isn't today, don't burn that bridge because you don't know when it would come back around. So I really like that point. Jamal, anything else to add on that?
Yes, I think strong go-to-market teams, they're not always selling, right? But they want to be informative. They want to be able to tell you as a customer, hey, here's what's going on. You don't have to do anything today, but just be aware of what's coming down the road. I think those that have done well, even as, and I remember when I was sitting in the seat as an SDR, we'd have a newsletter. So I would just send the newsletter out just to stay top of mind. Wasn't trying to get a meeting for my outside sales rep, but just making sure I just kind of stay top of mind. So I think companies that understand, once again, building the relationship. The relationship doesn't always have to be a sales relationship, but just sometimes just exchanging of data in that way.
Yeah, you're a place that they can come to for information. Correct. And one day that information may be, I need your product now. And so how do you create that?
Yeah.
Well, it could be a small company, right? You tend to sell to larger companies, yeah. And they're saying, we can't afford you. And you say, oh, well, you're at this point right now. Here's a company that I think could, it helps. I know it sounds crazy to give a sale away, but I've seen it where you give a sale away and you get a sale back. Why?
Yep.
Because that person that you were selling to goes to a big company now or moves or has a friend that's at a company. They become your referral. So there's a lot of different ways to kind of network and go to market. And I think those that understand how to leverage it, not always selling, tends to win out the most, in my opinion.
Yeah, I like to call it selling without selling out. You know, you're actually trying to be helpful. I think you still have to have a shining penny in your hand in terms of the product. I see more of that is taking place these days than in the past. When you operate in the market that, you know, everybody's buying, it's easy to sell.
Correct.
Because companies can't afford to splurge and experiment. Yes, it's more dependent on your ability to sell.
Right.
When everybody's trying to focus only on what's needed, you have to target the indispensability of your solution and your product. And that means that the whole focus is shifting towards the solution, not selling skills. And maybe I'm wrong. You know, probably a lot of sellers will tell me I'm nuts, right? This is not true. But I think that if you look at it as macro level, this is what you're going to see, right? That's where the companies these days investing. And that's right. What I think is just putting the go-to-market team on the back foot. And to Kyle and your Jamal point, I think the teams are getting educated how to produce the insight out of the data that help them to be more productive, because that's going to drive the sale, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So the propensity to buy on the customer side, that's the first step to identify somewhere in the data so that you don't have those empty cycles. I don't know, you guys thinking the same way, you see the same thing, but I feel like because of the cycle we are in, that's another attribute of that cycle definition.
both you and Jamal put it in a way that I really like. And one thing that I found is, you know, people don't necessarily buy a product. They buy from people they like. People don't necessarily want to be sold to. They want to be treated like human beings. And I think that goes a long way in terms of the sales cycle, especially these days where with the boom of AI, you honestly have a lot of startups with very comparable solutions. And it's very hard to tell from a demo or a discovery call exactly how that solution is going to be fundamentally different. But I think just that human approach, in spite of all this technology that we're seeing, I don't think that's something that's necessarily going to be lost anytime soon.
Absolutely not. Yep. We talked a little bit already about diversity of thought. I think diversity and inclusion is always a hot topic when it comes to recruiting. And so I want to touch on, you know, what's a good approach to go to market and what do you use in go to market recruiting efforts to make sure you're thinking about diversity and inclusion? And then what are some of the benefits of it? I mean, I think we all know what a lot of the benefits are when we see like female leaders in Fortune 500 companies and diverse team sets, but would love to hear from your perspective.
The way I always try to think about it is just making sure you're introducing the talent, right? I mean, I think what you hear fundamentally around maybe why teams aren't diverse is it's not out there. I think that's part of it. And I think as recruiters sometimes, because of the focus on filling the search, right, completing the search, we're always looking for whoever, the lowest hanging fruit sometimes. And so, you know, that might look like, I don't know, certain male that went to MIT, right, that worked at Google. So you start to get into these particular like niche candidates, if you want, or stereotypes, whatever you want to call it. So I think for me, it's always just being mindful of, can I introduce the talent? So what that means is putting in the extra sourcing cycles to make sure that I surface that talent and then putting it before. Now, once again, they have to be those that fit the profile. And sometimes if you know the hiring manager well enough, there are times where I presented candidates, whether they be diverse or not diverse, that didn't fit the spec exactly. But there's something about this person. I said, if you give them the opportunity, I know they're going to be successful in the company. And typically that happened more when I was in-house versus being in a firm. But you can build that kind of muscle, right? You can build that kind of equity, right, with the hiring manager or founder to make sure that they're like, yeah, you've been true to what you said before about candidates being successful. I like what you brought to the table. So for me, it's about just introducing them as early and often as possible and equipping them with everything that they need to go into this interview, but also understanding too that it's an environment that's going to be inclusive. There's no sense in putting someone into an environment where it's not going to work. I was reading the book Power Law, and it talked about how Kleiner Perkins wanted to put women into these VC partner roles, but they weren't really ready to help them in the role. So you had these powerful, strong women that went into this place, and it was still the old boys club, right? And so I think you have to be mindful in how you approach it. So as much as you want to have diversity, the inclusion part, the belonging part is just as important. And so you have to make sure that that's also there.
Yeah, I was listening to Malcolm Gladwell. He has a new book out. I was listening to him on a podcast, and there's something around like, I can't remember the exact numbers. You have a better memory than me, but you need at least, if there's a board of seven people, you need three of them to be women or people of color or whatever it is. Like if you just put one token person on that board, it's not going to work. They need like some numbers behind them. And so really thinking about if you want to build out a diverse leadership team and it's five white men, throwing a woman in that mix only is going to be hard unless the culture really allows for that person to thrive.
But let's just think about it from a simple, like just how people think, right? If you're in a room full of men that think the same versus a woman, you're like, how do I get my thought across, right? Without pushing the edge too much or sounding like a bee or whatever. So there's all these things that you have to think about, right? Instead of just being your natural self, you're having to feel like you have to defend every point that you make versus like, oh, this is a great idea. There's numerous studies, right, that talk about when there's a diverse team, how much more success you're going to have. I mean, that's just, it's in the numbers. And once again, not to get too political, but I think there will be obviously wide changes to the whole approach to that. I think there'll be different language used around it. I know that I've talked to a number of chief diversity officers, and, you know, one of the things that come out of their mouth very quickly is we have to do things now to mitigate legal risk, right? And so their whole approach is different in terms of how they used to do things. So you may have had a program that was set up for up-and-coming directors that were Black or Hispanic or women, and they now have to change that so that it's more inclusive for everyone. So there will be some things that change. I do think there will be certain allies and certain companies, right, that still stand firm behind having diverse teams. But I do think the language will change and the approach will change and how people do it.
I mean, it's been such an evolution throughout my career. I can only assume it'll change and hopefully continue for the better. I want to switch a little bit. Kyle, you've mentioned data and analytics quite a bit in general of like how go-to-market teams can be successful and individuals can be successful. I'm curious to hear from you on how companies can leverage data analytics when it comes to their hiring processes and what that looks like.
Yeah, so it's something that I spend a lot of time on, just personally kind of looking through everything from the top of funnel and outbound metrics, you know, how many people are even reading and responding to my message positively. And then I'm a big believer with regards to pass-through percentages, if that makes sense. And then to kind of go a little bit deeper in terms of what that is, I think every company has their kind of interview process orchestrated in a way where there's typically a first initial phone interview. Maybe with go-to-market, it's pretty common where they go to a panel style interview. And as a recruiter, just kind of thinking through, are we seeing healthy pass-through percentages? I often, when I'm working with clients, say you kind of want to be around 50%. I mean, maybe 25% one way or another in terms of pass-through percentages. If anything spikes below or you know more than that, we may be in a situation where there's false negatives or false positives going through the process. And let's kind of diagnose why that is and really try to peel that layer back. But you know, interviewing, let's just call a spade, it's very time consuming. If you're a salesperson and you're spending time interviewing people, that's not time that you're spending with your customer. And these long recruiting process where you may want to talk to 40 people to get one offer out, you know, I just don't know if you're using that person's time as efficiently as you could be doing. So again, I think it just kind of goes back to looking at the numbers and really trying to be efficient and timely while still getting to a point where you can make an effective decision that you're confident in.
Yeah, I think one of the things I've heard from hiring managers and recruiters and seen myself is like, one job rec is getting thousands of applications. And so mm-hmm. You both mentioned using AI yourself to help whittle through that. But it's like, how do you get the best candidates out of that bunch?
Yeah, that's a tough one. And it's honestly a very recent phenomenon. And I'll give you some examples with a client I was working with earlier this year. And for the record, I'd made plenty of great hires from an inbound mm-hmm. applicant. But this year they were like, hey, you know, our bandwidth stretched thin. We have thousands of applications to go through. Do you mind taking a spin through it? I didn't use AI. I manually looked through 500 resumes. From those 500 resumes, oh, wow. I spoke to three people.
500?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
I spoke to three people of those 500. Unfortunately, all three of those people I rejected. So, you know, those are just some of the numbers that we're experiencing. But I think there's just with Indeed and LinkedIn, it's just very easy to apply for jobs these days. And I was speaking with a friend of mine who just received his MBA earlier this spring. And he was saying, hey, it's been pretty tough applying to jobs. And I said, it's nothing against you. The reality is, it doesn't matter how qualified you are. What are the odds that a recruiter sees your resume from the thousands that they have to sift through? And internal teams these days are strapped pretty thin. They're very bandwidth constrained. So yeah, really in kind of the last couple of years, I think we're seeing a very unfortunate phenomenon with regards to the function of recruiting where, you know, there's just so many inbound leads and it's tough to sift through. You know, recently, most of the hires that I've made are either through the company's network or through someone that I prospected in terms of just reaching out to. You know, I'm curious how the industry is going to evolve and shift, but, you know, the inbound application, I'm kind of the opinion that it may be somewhat archaic at this point.
Or that it needs to be made harder, right? Like if, you know, you really have to send in a thoughtful resume with additional questions or a presentation or like something that actually says like, hey, I'm really committed to applying for this job and I'm interested in it. But yeah, it seems very network dependent. We're kind of already going into like some of the emerging trends in go-to-market leadership and recruiting. I'm curious, what other trends are you seeing, Jamal? Is there anything else coming up?
I think the biggest thing is really leaning on people that have strong technical backgrounds. Mm-hmm. You know, I was talking to a friend that does customer success, and he's like, customer success used to be more like, you know, the person that handled like a customer's onboarded. So just keeping them happy, you know, doing the renewal. But it's become a lot more technical in some aspects in terms of what they're looking for in some of the background. So I think that's been the biggest thing that I've seen is really that. And those that I think Dimitri talked about a little bit around it is those that really know the skill set, right? So I tell people all the time, they're like, well, I've done this before. I'm like, yeah, you've done this before, but this person's actually did it, right? So you're competing against people that have actually done the work versus those that are kind of like, oh, well,
I've done a little bit of this, I've done a little of that. I'm like, the market, there's just so much competition, right? And so there are some good candidates in the whole mix of bad candidates. And so you have to kind of weed through that. But I would say, to his point, being able to have someone walk you to the front of the line is going to be helpful. So the better you can leverage your network that way. And then those that just have the ability to do the job, right? Because people don't have time to get you totally ramped up anymore. It's like, I need you to pretty much hit the ground almost running.
And in the customer success anecdote, it's like, that's the do more with less, right? We might have had a full team of sales engineers that could support a lot of those questions in the past. How many of those do you have left? And what can the CS person step in and do?
Even salespeople running their own demos now. I mean, I used to always tell people the true salesperson was the sales engineer, right? The SE is the one that made the money. They're the ones that actually baked the cake, did all the stuff, right? It was a salesperson that came in, just put a little frosting on it, did a little decoration, and then they're the grand person. But
I think there was a too big gap between these two, to be frank, right? Like, if you look at the unit economics from anyone who is doing planning around the headcounts, you have to change the role description, right? You know what I mean?
Without a doubt.
By the way, that's really where it starts. A lot of managers don't do this, but it really starts with the job description. What are these people supposed to do? Because that will drive your unit economics and ultimately your cost and budget. And very often, the companies were just forgetting about that, right? They were thinking in a more traditional way, I'm going to hire more of these, so there's a ratio for these guys, I'm going to bring that. Okay, there you go. That's not necessarily the cost-effective or CFO-like thinking. And definitely, if that's not a CFO-like thinking, that's not the investor's thinking. They want to maximize every ROI on every single dollar, right? They're spending on you. So why would you go and splurge so much on that? Now, going back to your point, I think educating people makes sense to that, like, they can do their own basic demo so that you don't have to hire these expensive pre-sales guys, right?
Yeah.
They are expensive. But I have a question regarding the trend on the technical side, because you mentioned that that's the shift. You think this is because of the expectation that we hire more of the specialists these days? People who really can do work instead of just talk and be this thoughtful leader? Or you think this is the ripple effect of the AI that is enabling them to do this?
Yeah, probably a little bit of both. I mean, I just think, you know, even as a BDR making an outbound call, you really want to be able to spin a little bit around the product, because ultimately, the more you understand the product and how it works technically, the more value, right, you could add in that call from a sales perspective to see if it truly aligns with what the customer is looking for. So I do think, versus just reading off a script, you know, hi, this is Jamal from Palo Alto Networks. It's like, you know, this is Jamal from Palo Alto Networks, our security, looking at what you guys do in terms of your work. Here's how our particular product, right, technically fits into that. So being a little bit more thoughtful in how we make that initial call, because time is precious right now, right? No one wants to spend extra time. So I think the better you are from that technical component, right, where you can kind of speak to it at a high level, don't say you have to get into deep. It does. It helps to kind of speed things up.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And I don't think it's necessarily like, oh, you need to have studied computer science to be a great VP of sales. But I have seen that a lot of the products are inherently becoming increasingly more technical. They're used by technical people. And I think just in terms of being able to talk that talk and be able to understand what exactly the product does, I mean, these are solutions where if you're at your Thanksgiving dinner trying to explain it to family and friends, a lot of people aren't going to have any clue what it is that solution's doing, and really being able to distill it quickly and succinctly to the proper audience, I think is massive. So I think a little bit of it is just having the intellectual curiosity to not only understand your product, but the space and what the solution is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I can see this. Like, you don't want to talk about these things at the table with your family during the holiday season. You know, they can choke, you know, listen to you. That's a hazard.
But here's what I will say, though. One last point to that. So as much as there's the technology drive, right, as much as there's AI, there's still the human element that we can't get rid of, right? I think ultimately, and this is where when I think about recruiters and some of the conversations we have, it's like, are we going to get pushed out? And I'm like, I don't think we'll ever get pushed out. I do think there will be things that help to augment what we do, but I don't think we will, because I still need to negotiate the contract with you or your salary or get feedback. I think as much as certain things can be automated, at some point, right, you're going to have to still have a human element. If you're doing a 7-figure sale, you're not going to do that through AI. You need people that are sitting across from each other at the table, right, talking and hooking out a pin and signing the doc. But I just think there's certain things that won't change. As much as technology's there, I think there will be roles that probably get impacted to some degree. But I do think, you know, ultimately there's the human element's not going anywhere.
Yeah, I agree with you. There's a change though in this approach. So let me compare this to old way of supply chain to your groceries, right?
Uh-huh.
Or anything you're buying today from Amazon, you were buying in the past, you know, going to the grocery or like big shopping mall, right? You're driving, you're just putting things in your cart, and then you bring this back home. These days, the things are done differently, right? Not only you have a big truck, they're just allocating that because of the planes delivered this between the big cities on a 24 hours schedule, right? And then you still have a last mile delivery. There's somebody that is driving this to your home. And I think it's going to be a similar with the sales. I think the buyers will do a lot of their own research because the AI will enable them to do this. The more AI personalization is approaching and is getting into our lives, that will be easier than it was before.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree that at some point the seller has to come in and you want to have that human touch. You want to talk through the things. You want to get some validation. But I don't think it's going to be in this early stage of outreach at the scale that we were operating before. Right.
Sure.
I don't think this is going back, by the way.
Well, we're all educated consumers now, right? I mean, even for me, if I go to the doctor now, I'm going in saying, hey, I have a more intelligent and informed conversation now because I've done the research ahead of time. So buyers, I mean, I've read blog posts where, you know, sellers are like, oh my God, it's so much harder to sell now. Well, yeah, because the buyer knows what they want. They know the competition. They understand it. So by the time they're talking to you, it's like, show me what the true differentiator is. I got to hear it, read it, right, from the videos and things, but now really talk to me as to why I should go with your product versus this one. So to your point, yeah, things are changing now because we're a lot more intelligent because of the resources that are available to us, for sure.
We were chatting a little bit about SDRs. There's nothing I hate more than like doing a bunch of research and reaching out to learn about a product and talking to an SDR first. I'm like, what a waste of effing time. I want a demo. I want my questions answered, and here's where it is. But the thing that when people talk about AI, it's going to take away jobs. And, you know, what I really think it's going to impact is some of those entry level jobs. And I know you guys do more of the executive recruiting side, but I'm curious what your thoughts are on that, of like, how do people enter the industry now into sales if there's not an SDR job, or into RevOps if there's not like a data entry job that they can start on? And what do you think is going to happen on that side of things?
I used to recruit for SDRs, right? And so I would go to the college campus and talk to them. So those that I really kind of leaned into were those that did alumni recruiting, right? So they knew how to pick up a phone. So they'd call alumni, hey, can you donate to this or that? Or at some point had some kind of sales job while they were in school. So I think what's going to happen now is they're going to have people that probably come out of computer science type stuff, right? So someone that's already got a technical aptitude where they're on the phone because of their skill set as a technology person versus just someone that can smile and dial. So I do think it's going to be a challenge. That bar for entry will be a lot tougher now than it was before, because once again, until it changes where we're now pulling, you know, building at all cost, but right now where things are streamlined, you're trying to find the most talented person. And so many times, those are people that already have that technical aptitude, that have a personality where you can go, okay, you know, at some point you can either transition into being a sales engineer or you can transition into being an AE. I think that's where things are going for a BDR. I don't think it's just going to be happy-go-lucky Susie Sally, right? That can just pick the phone up. It's going to be the person that really understands when I get on the phone. That's a geek, right? That's just technically inclined, that wants to get in and dig in the weeds and, oh, I built this AI project when I was in school. Like, those are the people I think that'll be successful as a BDR now. Kyle, your thoughts?
On the topic of AI, I think I'm of a certain age where the first thing I think of, honestly, when I hear AI, my mind goes to the Terminator and the Matrix. And there's a lot of inherent fear about AI. Yeah, but that being said, I think from what I've seen in the industry over the last few months, honestly, I am kind of a big believer in it having a positive impact. And I'm not one of these people that thinks AI is going to take away jobs. What I do think it's going to do, though, is change how people do their jobs. And I think a lot of the very time consuming menial tasks, I think we've seen enough at the moment where artificial intelligence can save you a lot of time and ultimately free you up to do a lot more interesting, creative things. So any entry level function, it doesn't matter if it's a software engineer or an SDR or BDR, the people who can leverage the available technology to make their lives easier, I think are going to be the people who win out.
Yeah. And hopefully college, you know, education has changed a little bit to be more and more around that. Right. And so they're coming in with inherent knowledge that someone like me might not have, because I didn't learn that in school. So
Leading up to this session today, I actually came across this thing on LinkedIn where a gentleman was talking just about that. And he basically said, you know, we're already seeing AI agents that can handle entry-level sales tasks. They can qualify leads, schedule meetings, even run initial discovery calls. I was like, whoa. And I mean, he's like, this is mostly via email automation, though a few vendors are actually experimenting with this technology now. One is called PuppyDog.io, which provides AI-generated personalized demos. Another company is OneMind that provides AI agents that can join meetings, give presentation, and answer questions autonomously. And I'm like, whoa, okay. Now that's kind of going into a different realm there. So once again, as we talk about technology, how it's evolving, there's companies already that are thinking about just that, right? How do we take away the SDR function?
Yeah, I think there's a technology and there's a readiness to take that on the buyer side. So this is going to take a moment before people are really accustomed to that way of buying. But I think it's going to, like you said, you both said that, right? Like we're shifting on the skill side and a kind of adoption process to this whole new, brand new world. So thinking about that, thinking about the colleges and the kind of the fresh graduates, let's talk about the skills gaps. Like what are the skills gaps that you see currently in the go-to-market space? I mean, you mentioned a little bit about the technical aspects of work and understanding the product. What else, guys, you see?
Being a strategic thinker. I always go back to, in the phrase that's in my head, because that was kind of what we always talked about at Sequoia was, you know, how do you see around the corner? Right? How do we see what's kind of ahead of us? And so I think those that can kind of think strategically, leverage AI, right, to work more efficiently and, you know, using certain tools to help you kind of get ahead, I think is really what's going to be beneficial. So I think, once again, those that don't think about things technically, like I talk about former colleagues of mine that don't want to invest in AI in any way, you're just going to get left behind. I mean, that's just the long and short of it. We talked about technical literacy, just being adaptable, I guess, ultimately is what it comes down to, right? Can you adapt to what's going on? Change is happening. How do I adapt to that change versus just kind of sitting back and waiting on it?
Yeah, I think Jamal touched on some points that I would certainly second. I was thinking intellectual curiosity and research oriented people who know their product inside and out. They're willing to take the time to understand the trends in the industry and frankly, like some of the limitations of their own product. Not everything out there is going to be perfect, but trying to figure out the best way to frame it in a way where if it's the right solution, obviously you want to encourage whoever you're selling to take it on. But you know, the function's changed enough where we've talked about it earlier. I definitely think it's more of a partnership than necessarily the slick talking used car salesman, if that makes sense. Like you're really trying to not just sell a solution, but hopefully sell a solution that they're going to continue to use and pay that subscription fee on.
These are valid points, guys. I see there's even more on that front. They're like looking ahead and having a good story. That's always going to be some skill that is in demand. No matter where you are, this is a history of economics. That's what drives those people that are investing in these new startups. That's how these founders actually come up with these ideas and convince the investors, like, you know, give me money, I'll build you something, right? We all need to learn a little bit of that. I think we need to be more entrepreneurial than ever before.
Yes.
No matter what we do. Mm-hmm. You are a technical person, engineer, business manager. You have to be entrepreneurial. And I think that's what a lot of these new technologies are facilitating and creating some sort of catalyst for that type of a reward that's coming after. But there's another trend on the market that I want to talk about. It's the remote work and the hybrid models. You know, a lot of companies just trying to bring back the employees to the office. So Kyle, let me start with you. Like what do you see on your end and how you think this is going to end up?
Right off the bat, I will say in the last year and a half, the amount of companies that I've supported that have been fully remote, it's two. So it's definitely a trend that seems to be, you know, progressively heading towards going back into the office. As a recruiter, one thing I tell founders is you simply have to look at the numbers. If you want to have the biggest talent pool of qualified people, you need to be open to people who will want to go into the office and people who are used to being high performing and still being remote. All that being said, I understand that there's a lot that goes into the culture that companies and founders are trying to build. So I totally respect if they want there to be an office space for in-person collaboration and they want to settle on a hybrid or even 5 days a week. But we're certainly seeing a big trend in terms of going back into the office, especially for early stage companies. I think the fundamental thing that they're trying to solve for is without having a lot of formal structure and a way to collaborate easily, I think they're just trying to, you know, check that box mm-hmm. by people being organically all in the same spot. And I can totally respect that. All that being said, I think there's some companies where there just may be some inherent distrust of who they're hiring, and they kind of want to, you know, be able to look over the cubicle and see what that person's doing. So again, I'm supportive of the return to office, provided it's for the right reasons. And it's definitely a trend that I'm seeing a lot more these days. Just from a pure financial perspective, I am somewhat surprised, you know, in the geography that we're in, the San Francisco Bay Area, how many founders and investors are comfortable with companies using that overhead for pretty expensive office space. I don't think that's actually being talked about nearly enough. And for what it's worth, you know, there's a certain premium and cost of living that comes with basing your company in San Francisco or New York, where there may be comparable talents in other places for, you know, fractions of what that is. So yeah, I mean, I have a lot of thoughts on it, but I don't know if I necessarily see the return to office slowing down anytime soon.
No, I don't either. And I think I'll just dovetail on the last point you made. I think a lot of it has to do with these leases that they couldn't get out of. And they're like, hey, we need you back in here, right? Like, because it's costing us a lot of money. I do think for, you know, certain scenarios, it does make sense even from a hybrid. I mean, I'll admit, I mean, I don't work or live in the Silicon Valley, so I'm 2 hours away. So being able to go in a couple of days a week was nice to kind of help with getting ramped up, being able to meet with partners or meet with other colleagues. So there is something to be said for some in-person, but I would say that in large part, I probably get more done at home just because I don't have the water cooler talk, if you will, right? There isn't someone stepping into my office or cube to kind of banter over certain things. But, you know, once again, I think there is a point where it does make sense to kind of come together. I don't know that it has to be every day, but, you know, whatever that happy balance is. But I remember Verkada. They were very much in front of being in the office every day and lost tons of candidates because of that. Like, cause people were like, I'm not going back in the office. So there's some that have stood behind it, you know, and as some of the stuff we're seeing in the headlines now, right, with certain companies that are asking people to come back in 5 days a week. So we'll see how it shifts. Just like how the whole push and move for, you know, DEI was the thing, you know, remote was the thing, and things find ways to kind of fade back to normalcy, if you will, at some point.
I don't know if I've actually seen any data around someone being fully remote and them not being just as high performing if they're in the office. I mean, a little bit of it kind of goes back to what we were saying just with regards to personal discipline and organization. But I'll tell you firsthand, I mean, I was commuting to Menlo Park in San Francisco for a large part of my career. Not having to be on a train for 2 hours a day where I functionally can't do any work, I think has unblocked me to be a little bit more efficient in that regard. But I totally get that fully remote's not for everybody also.
It's not. And I think most of us are social animals. We like to be among the people. I also speak through my experiences. I would love to have, you know, 1 or 2 days, maybe 3 days a week just to meet other people in the office,
yeah.
Right? No matter where I work. So it sounds like it's going to stay somewhere in the halfway through. Some companies will push this. Some companies won't. Some companies will actually take advantage because they can just get the better talent. We talked a little bit about the AI and automation. Is there anything specific that is changing the recruiting process with the AI? I mean, I've seen that some of the companies actually were clearly stating that their ATS is AI-based.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know to what extent that's true. I don't know to what extent really is effective, but I have a lot of questions about, you know, how this really works. But what is your take? What do you see, guys?
Jamal, I'm curious what your take on it is. I know there's a lot of people out there these days who said, oh, my resume got rejected by AI. I just don't see a product out there that does that, to be perfectly honest with you. For me as a recruiter, and I may be a little late in fairness adopting certain AI tools relative to some of my colleagues, but it has made certain time-consuming tasks that, frankly, you don't need a human eye to do, like scheduling, for instance. The ability to just save some clicks and save a few minutes of my day for some of those things, that's totally helped. But, you know, Jamal kind of mentioned earlier, there's just an inherent human experience when you're recruiting and dealing with people where it saves me time from some of the more tedious aspects of my job. But, you know, I don't know if I necessarily will believe that I'm going to be replaced by AI anytime soon. It's probably a lot more limited than people believe it is in terms of the application with regards to recruiting.
And I would just say, I think when you're at a bigger company, you're talking about Jim that has the AI, and I did the demo. It's really for larger companies that are looking at, you know, thousands of resumes, having to think about different organizations and how do you separate that and being able to track your university recruiting and just your regular applicants. But for me, at a smaller, I use it for some scheduling here or there. I use chat for like email, verification, making sure it's doing my edits there. But no, I don't see it being a big thing for me. But a large organization, I could see where you're going to use certain functions to do automation, help with scheduling. I could see where a startup company, there are some tools where as a hiring manager, it could help you with thinking about profiles and how you would do resumes, putting together presentations. It could help with that. To your point, Kyle, around scheduling. So there are things that I think when you're a smaller company, there's things you could leverage AI to help with, some of the kind of menial tasks. But I think for its big usage, I think the larger companies are probably getting the biggest bang for the buck from it. Yes, in my opinion.
Yeah. So there's a flip side to this, right? There's a lot of candidates are trying to gamify this whole thing.
Absolutely. Right?
And they're using the AI to write things that are just perfectly tying to the job description and the expectations. So how do you set up the process that is bulletproof on that front? Is there a way?
It's funny because I was talking to a friend about this literally like 2 weeks ago, and you'd be dumb to do that because at some point you have to show where you did this work, right? So if you're going to just put in, and because I've heard people say that, well, copy the job description and put it in and that now becomes your resume. I'm like, okay, but you then have to show where you did the work. There's reference checks that would qualify whether you did it or not. There's back channels. So there's a way to kind of essentially get around the BS that you've now put out there. So I just think that's the dumbest thing to do. Yeah, I hear people trying to figure out a way to gamify it that way. It just doesn't make any sense to me. But
I think there's some nuance to it. And what I mean by that is I think if you're showcasing yourself in an inauthentic way, I would just professionally encourage you not to do that. You don't want to end up in a position where you're just totally out in front of your skis and you're not qualified to do that work. That would be a failure. Conversely, I am a believer that like the AI is there and you'd be somewhat silly not to leverage the tools at your disposal. Once you're in the job, no one's going to say, oh, don't use the AI tool that's out there and free to use. I've even seen some companies saying, I know this isn't a software engineering recruiting podcast, but I've seen certain companies say, if you're a software engineer and you want to use ChatGPT for a coding interview, like go ahead. No one's going to say you can't use that once you're in the seat. So to a degree, I feel like, use the tools that are at your disposal, but do it in a way where, you're still authentic and showcasing yourself in an appropriate way.
Something to that point around authenticity. I actually was talking to a prospective client and he asked, how would I go about finding candidates? And I told him, through my network, through LinkedIn. He goes, so you're not going to use AI to kind of surface candidates? I said, if I had to, he goes, well, I prefer you not, right? Our brand is about customer interaction and I want it to feel authentic. And so for him, AI was like, it was like taboo. He doesn't want someone, because I think there have been recruiters that say, oh, well, we use AI to surface all this talent. So I think it depends on who you're talking to, right? Your audience and what they're looking for. Whereas this guy said, I want authentic, organic outreach versus just this automation type of outreach. So I thought that was pretty unique. So, one small little anecdote, but something to kind of think about, right? As we're talking to certain founders and how they think about, building their teams and us as recruiters and how we go about helping them build their teams.
We should clip together all the times we say, Demetrius, on this podcast, how much we hate automated outreach and how it doesn't do anything, because it's very similar to what that guy just said. So, I think that makes sense, right? It doesn't want you sending out thousands of similar emails to people.
I agree with you all about short-living success if you lied about your experience. At some point, even if you get a job, if you can't demonstrate, that's going to impact you, right? Like, it's going to create a lot of stress. It's going to start realizing that, this is way above my ability. Here's another curveball here, because a lot of people started to use that, and there's a limited number of jobs these days. A lot of people who don't, they feel like they're getting penalized. There's not much way they can really trick the system, because, on the one hand, they have ethical rules and they never break. Right? They don't write anything that is not true. They don't tweak things in words, because they feel like that's not necessarily what they've done. But at the same time, they don't get interviews. So what would be your recommendation to these individuals?
So if I'm understanding your statement correctly, you're saying that people aren't getting interviews because people are using AI
essentially grew up by the system to get ahead of the line versus anyone.
So some people that are actually applying, they don't tweak these things versus those that do and they get interviews. Well, assumption, because they fit better, right? And to your point, if there is a company that has a limited recruiting resources, that won't go through like Kyle did, 500 resumes, right? Like they're going to just use the ATS or whatever comes off top. It's the best. Boom. Bring them in. And I feel like there's a lot of candidates right now on the market. They just wonder, okay, what should I do? They're torn, right? Do I go with that bad practice or I stick to what I believe is the right way and I don't do that?
I think here's the better question is, are those people getting the job? Right? It's one thing to get the interview. I get that. You're skipping the line, you get the interview. But the question, what everyone's trying to get to is get the job. So if you're saying that doing that has helped me get the job, granted, you have to have the interview in order to get the job. So I get that. But that would be my question. Because once again, if you're doing things to tweak it to help, okay, maybe instead of using the word, you know,
I deployed.
Exactly, right? So things like that, sure. But at some point, you still have to talk about how you deployed it, right? How you went about doing it, and does it fit with what we're looking for as a company? So I don't know. And once again, I probably have to be at a bigger company to have a true answer to that question, because I'm only working with, you know, smaller these companies. But I think if I had to go back, like if I was at Palo Alto Networks, we're still going to interview the candidate. Is there a culture ad, right? So there's still elements that we still have to go through. And ultimately, are we going to hire this person? So yeah, you could gamify it, get to the head of the line, but are you getting the job? I guess that's more important to me than just gamifying your resume.
What I would tell people at a high level is just don't compromise your own values and integrity. I know it may be painful. You know, you may feel like there's a lot of short-term pressure, but I'm a little old-fashioned. I think there's one time where, I'm not exaggerating, when I was actually a candidate being interviewed, I got a phone call. I was in a parking lot at the time. They said, hey, you know, we want to extend you the offer. Can you log into your computer and go on DocuSign and sign? And I go, I'm about to be off the grid for the next 3 weeks. Like, I'm not going to have access to a computer. You're just going to have to take me at my word that I will sign the offer. And they go, oh, I don't know about that. I go, I'm giving you my word. Like, I will show up when I say I will. In 3 weeks, I will sign the offer. So you just have to trust me. And I think, you know, to a degree, I would encourage people who are in that position, Demetrius, to feel similarly. You know, don't compromise your values for, you know, whatever that short-term win is.
I agree.
Which is tough, especially if you've been someone that's been on the sideline for a little while. I talked to a number of people that have been that way. And it's tough. I mean, you're trying to think of every way possible to get in, and you've used your network that hasn't worked, and you're applying and that's not working. And so, you know, I wish there was some magic wand. Like my mom used to tell me whenever I got a boo-boo that I could just wave and you'd be healed. But it just, you know, it's not how life works sometimes. You want to just deal with the scrape on the elbow, right, until it heals.
Just keep getting up and trying again.
That's it. Yeah.
We've chatted about a bunch of like trends and what you guys see in the future. Any last predictions that you want to share about what you think is going to happen over the next few years when it comes to go-to-market leadership and recruiting?
That's the Nostradamus section of our podcast. Okay, guys.
The magic wand.
The crystal prediction.
Ball. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I'll answer that in two ways. I think, you know, just from a short-term lens, what does 2025 look like? I have noticed, at least in last few weeks, anecdotally, it does seem like a lot of companies are starting to hire pretty aggressively. So I personally think that trend's going to continue. I think capital is being redeployed again, especially at the early stage stuff. You know, I think there's a lot of really interesting things happening, you know, kind of at the Series A level, maybe even earlier than that. And I definitely think that'll continue come 2025. You know, to answer part of your question, long term, 3-5 years from now, what's that look like? It's admittedly tough to say. And I think just because things change so quickly with regards to Silicon Valley, I am a believer in AI, but I think there's some nuance to it in the sense that I want to see what it's solving or what the application is. You can't just be a fun science project and to kind of like come full circle to something that we were talking about earlier. I think too many companies prioritize like shiny new technology over what the market needs and a problem that's being solved. So I think that's one thing is, you know, even if you're an AI company, what's the application? What's the fundamental problem that's being solved? And then for the go-to-market function, in particular, I think we've talked a lot about, you know, it being increasingly, I guess, analytical, cerebral. And I absolutely think that that's true of that role, you know, someone with the intellectual curiosity to kind of go the extra mile versus, you know, I think 10, 20 years ago, like we were saying, you know, smile and dial would kind of pay dividends. And I think as a function, it's a bit more sophisticated these days.
What about you, Jamal?
Leading up to this call, once again, part of that LinkedIn thing, he mentioned he anticipates three go-to-market motions will emerge. So we have what he called PLG, and then he talked about AI-led and then consumption-based pricing. So how these typically models will start to kind of influence, right, what kind of go-to-market leaders we hire. And then he just indexed back. He said, so prioritizing around culture ad, right? So making sure you've got the right people that understand the mission, where we're going directionally, what we're going to do. People that he talked about were adaptable and had a certain, you know, level of drive to get there, and then investing in ongoing development, right? So we talk about AI, we talk about the changes, but what are we doing to make sure that we stay ahead of it and that our team is staying ahead of those things? And so I had different thoughts, but when I saw that, I'm like, that makes all the sense in the world, right? So when we're thinking about go-to-market, it's all about that. How do we stay ahead of the game? And really all of those things kind of focus into, once again, do we have the right team in place? Are the people that can adapt? And are they coachable, right? So that we can continue to move down the road. And that goes all the way to the leadership as well, right? Is the leadership open to change? Or are they willing to see, once again, around those corners and really understanding the trends of where things are going to go from a sales motion? So it's funny because we always talk about it as go-to-market. And I always think of go-to-market coming from a startup being, hey, how are we going to go to market? I think now we're in this place of how do we sustain what we've done and how do we grow, right? So it's more like grow to market, if you think about it. Which sounds kind of corny, but I think that's really what it should be thought of, right? It's once the company starts moving, is how do we continue to grow?
Yeah, I like that a lot. I think it's like a balance of looking around the corner and seeing what's coming without chasing shiny objects, which ties in both your answers of like, yes, AI is coming, we need to adopt it, and we don't need to build an AI product to say we build an AI product if it doesn't do anything.
Right. Which typically comes back to hurt you when you say you have something and then people start to dig in and they're like, yeah, this isn't what it says it is.
And now
you're working from a different standpoint. So
absolutely. Last but not least, I want to hear both of your top three suggestions around like the most important takeaways listeners should look for in hiring go-to-market talent. So Kyle, let's start with you.
Yeah, put me on the spot. I wish I would have thought about this, admittedly, a little more than I did. I think, you know, not to beat a dead horse too much, but I think, you know, someone who's intellectually curious, I think is massive. I think it'll pay dividends for someone to being able to do the research, understand the industry and the products. I think that's massive these days in terms of just the overall function. So I think that's one. Beyond that, get it out in front of it early. I think we were talking about it earlier, but not enough companies prioritize it. And if you have the budget to hire, I don't think there's anything wrong with hiring people to build the product and people to actually go out and sell the product. Go ahead and do that arguably earlier than you need to. And then if there's anything else, try to be a little creative around it. We were talking a little bit earlier about domain expertise, and I would probably go as far as to argue that I'd rather have someone who understands the clients versus the domain, if that makes sense. You know, certain clients have different sales cycles in terms of approvals. And I think, you know, that may be paying bigger dividends over the long term than just someone who knows the industry inside and out. I mean, industry's changed so quick, and I would probably say a smart enough person's going to be able to pick up, you know, the specific domain knowledge. And if you built the company in a way where there's enough experts in the space that are there, they're going to be able to ramp someone up.
That was good for on the spot. I like that. Yeah.
Thank you. Well, I have a lot of good ideas that I'm hearing from you all too.
He was just messing with you. Like he was just put on the spot. You know?
Yeah. Jamal, what about you?
I think the biggest thing for me as I think about the market is we talk about adaptability. I don't think I could use that word enough just because so much is changing so quickly. I do think, you know, getting out of your own way at times, meaning, you know, you're seeing what's going on. So thinking about the trends that are happening, how do you kind of stay ahead of it? Like take an AI course, right? There's a number of stuff out there. Find ways to educate yourself. So at the very least, you can fluff the language, right? You could talk the talk, if you will, right? Do that. And I'd say leverage technology. I mean, there's stuff out there. Why not leverage it? Why not leverage chat, like we said, to help maybe change some words around, but don't over index on using it for everything. And the other thing is use the heck out of your network. Like, you have to find ways to get ahead. I mean, I feel like I've got a good network. I've tried to leverage it for certain things. I wish I could be better at it in certain ways, but leverage the network, right? You built it up. Also, I would say follow people in the industry that you think are doing cool stuff, right? It's always good to kind of stay ahead of the game that way, because they're going to educate you on what's going on, how to stay ahead of certain trends. I don't think people do enough of that. Well, there's people that, hey, if you think they're cool and they're doing good stuff, follow them. The stuff I got was from this guy, Jocko, who's a great go-to-market leader. He's been a number of different startups. I follow the guy, and he always has good pearls of wisdom. Andy Price from Artisanal. I like to follow him because he's in the search world. So he talked about last week around this new administration. He doesn't care if it's Democrat or Republican. There's going to be some money thrown out right now, right? So get ready, because we'll probably get back to Kyle's point where, you know, there's going to be some cash thrown around. So now companies will start hiring again. So by third quarter, that could be really beneficial for some people. So for us in the staffing world, get ready for the potential tidal wave. So I just think things like that, right? Just making sure that you kind of keep your ear to the ground is always going to be the best solution in the long run. And bet on yourself sometimes. I mean, you just said it best, right? Be an entrepreneur. Sometimes you got to just bet on yourself and go, I'm going to take this risk. I'm going to take this chance, because I think ultimately it's going to lead to something. And so I have a mindset of always walking through life with your eyes open. It sounds simplistic. It sounds corny, but when you do that, you'll realize how the dots connect, right? Like how I got connected and how now Kyle and I will be connected. And you realize how you can kind of make things work from that and leverage that network that you build. So nothing just happens for any reason. Like even today, having to research some of the stuff for this call, I'm wiser now because of that, right? And so the dots will connect based on another call that I have now because of this information.
I hope you'll stay connected with me too. I noticed I wasn't mentioned in that network.
Oh, God.
But...
of course I'll stay connected to you. Yeah.
I thought she won't notice.
How could I not? You are the connector. I mean, based on what Darisha says, you are the connector.
No, this was so much fun. Thank you. It was nice to go down a little bit different path. And I think you guys shared a ton of awesome wisdom for people hiring and people looking to get hired. So thank you so much for both of your time.
Absolutely. Thanks, guys. Throw a question back at you two real quick, like what are you two seeing in the market? Like what are some things that maybe you could provide to Kyle and myself around, hey, are you guys seeing this? Or are you aware of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think we mentioned some of it. I think there's like the concern around the AI and like, what are we going to look for in entry level candidates? And I'm definitely seeing like the shiny object chasing, and that is directly in conflict with profitability or science projects, right? And so like leaders are still sometimes not striking the balance well enough. And I think there's a learning curve there. I think it's maybe there won't need to be a learning curve if a bunch of money's available. And then the only other thing that I don't think we really touched on is like, I think startups are eating some of these bigger companies lunch. Like I think they're moving quicker. You know, it'll be interesting to see if the acquisition market picks up and that's like a real viable opportunity for people to go start their own company again, or if I'm in partnership. So like, will you use a bunch of different products that have great interconnectivity and have a specific need? And does that consumption-based model become really compelling then instead of paying for a bunch of platform fees? So those are a few of the things I'm seeing. Demetrius, you always have a bunch of thoughts.
I think a couple of things. Number one, I see that the typical borders between the roles are getting blurred. I think we talked about like how AE is becoming a little bit more like a pre-sales because they have to. I think BDRs, SDRs, they act more like AEs. I think I see there's also a trend bringing together more acquisition and the customer success. So our customer success is becoming more sales-oriented function than only working on the relationship and to an extent support. Speaking about a customer success, I think support is another trend that is just about to obsolete. That part of the go-to-market definitely will be significantly reduced, and I think the AI will play a big role here. Another trend I see also is more investment in efficiency through enablement. So suddenly started to see a lot of roles that are sales enablement oriented. They focus on leverage that function, although I don't think the roles are properly defined. In my opinion, I'm happy to explore more on that front, but that's definitely a trend. The other one is, you mentioned that comment about the pricing change. I connect this directly with the AI, and the last 2 years of investments We heavily investing as a, you know, as a VC community, as a, you know, startup community into these AI-based companies. They're building the product a different way. They're going to be differently organized around the product as well. And that means go-to-market will be different. Heavily relying on the POG, you said that. And for that reason, the pricing will be different as well.
Yeah.
So all the three things that you mentioned are coming from that. And there's this new wave coming from the AI that will eventually push the existing incumbents, you know, that were in their own old way of doing building software into that adoption risk area. Mm-hmm. And I started to really see this. Like, you know, there are certain brands that, you know, they were dominating in their own category, but I think the star is just less shiny because you see those emerging, very effective, cost-effective companies. So yeah, these are the kind of the main trends I see,
mm-hmm.
you know, specifically for anyone who is in the go-to-market. My advice would be to invest in your ability to read the data. And it's not about having the data. It's about creating an insight. You can have all the data in the world, but if you can't create a synthesis of that, it's just worthless. So
you're just pining for more RevOps people and SalesOps people.
Yeah, but I also see that I think the CRO is shifting their focus too, because they can't rely on this old way of doing business.
Okay.
So they have to be extremely selective how they're going to allocate their resources and ask the, you know, board or CEO or CFO for extra resources, right? So they need to build a story based on the data, and that's a skill set that they were not equipped in the past.
Correct.
So I think the CRO is becoming more like a business people than historically were salespeople.
You need the ops team to help with that automation to some degree, or mm-hmm. your teams are hamstrung and not as impactful. So I'll say one more thing to be confrontational to Demetrius. I think you're losing out on, this is my personal opinion since I live in Vermont, you're losing out on so much talent not hiring remotely. Like, you couldn't pay me enough money in the world to go back to New York City. I will travel there whenever, but I want to ski in the morning. And I do think that, like, there's a fair amount of people who are like, I won't put myself in this category, but I will. High performers are just like, no, I'm not doing it, and I'll get a job somewhere else. So Kyle, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head of, like, you have to just admit that you're losing out on some portion of the job pool or the talent pool.
And Lindsay, that's music to my ears as someone who grew up in New England. So that makes me pretty happy. I honestly wish, you know, there were more startups from the area I grew up in. But I think there's unfortunately a lot of ego involved in, oh, you know, I want to take money from the investor on Sand Hill Road and things like that. It's not like Silicon Valley has any inherent natural resource that, you know, Vermont has, for what that's worth. There are like a tremendous amount of universities out here. I mean, there's some good ones, don't get me wrong, but I don't know. I think one of the great things about technology is you could conceivably scale a world-class company anywhere.
Yeah, absolutely.
In Power Law, they talk about that. So there was a Silicon Valley against Boston, right? Like, and there was this power play, and however it worked, Silicon Valley ended up winning out. But there was a power play where it was more of a older money idea, right, in terms of investing, like the New York old money versus the Silicon Valley, which is newer money, and VC and how that all worked. But yeah, to your point, Kyle and Lizzie, it very well could have been Boston. It could have been there. But luckily for us out here, right, this is where we struck gold. So
maybe one day Vermont will be a tech hub. Maybe.
I can't wait for that day. Vermont. I've never been there. So yeah.
Well, thank you guys again, and always happy to share our thoughts, of course. But this was excellent. I learned a lot and loved hearing your thoughts.
It was a pleasure, guys.
For the invite, I appreciate it.
No, we appreciate it.
Yeah, this was awesome. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the RepTech Podcast. Please subscribe on the listening platform of your choice and leave us a review to let us know how we're doing.